Tonight, we are going to spend some time with Jeremiah chapter 18. And the bulk of the chapter, the main section of the chapter, is really, I think, a reflection on, a meditation on God's sovereignty, God's responsiveness, and the relationship between those two things. What we'll see is on the surface a very simple parable. And the more we probe it, the more I think we'll realize that the parable is not actually all that simple after all. What I would like to do somewhat differently than previous sessions is I'd like to read the whole unit through, the first part of this chapter, at least not quite the whole unit, but most of the unit, and then discuss it after we've heard it. It's just not going to make a lot of sense to talk about it before we've heard it. I think many of you may be familiar with this, even if the words Jeremiah 18 don't conjure it for you. Hadavar asher haya el Yirmiyahu me'et Adonai le'mor. The word which came to Jeremiah from Hashem, kum v'yaradeta beit ha-yotzer v'shama ashmiacha et devarai. Go down to the house of the potter, and there I will cause you to hear my words. Va'ered beit ha-yotzer v'hinehu osem elacha al ha'avnaim. So I went down to the house of the potter, and there he was doing his work at the wheels. V'nishchat ha-kli asher hu oseh b'chomer b'yad ha-yotzer, v'shav v'yaseyu kli acher, kasher yashar b'inei ha-yotzer la'asot. And if the vessel that he was making was ruined, as sometimes happens to clay when it's in the potter's hands, he would turn and make it a different vessel, as seemed appropriate in his eyes. Vayihi dvar Adonai elai le'mor. Then the word of Hashem came to me. Hachayotzer hazeh lo uchal la'asot lachem beit Yisrael ne'um Hashem? Hine chachomer b'yad ha-yotzer, kein atem b'yadi beit Yisrael. Can I not deal with you like this potter, O house of Israel, says God? Just like clay in the hands of a potter, in the hands of the potter, so are you in my hands, O house of Israel. Rega adaber al goy v'al mamlacha, lintosh v'lintotz v'l ha'avid. At one moment, I may plan regarding a nation that it or regarding a kingdom that it shall be uprooted and pulled out and destroyed. Vishav hagoyahu meira'ato asher dibarti alav v'nichamti al hara'a asher chashavti la'asot lo. And if that nation against which I made a decree turns from its evil, I will change my mind regarding the evil that I planned to do to it. Virega adaber al goy v'al mamlacha livnot v'lintoa. At a different moment, I may plan regarding a nation or a kingdom to build it up and plant it. Ve'asa hara be'enai livilti shmoa b'koli. V'nichamti al hatova asher amarti lehitivoto. But if it does what is evil in my eyes, refusing to listen to my voice, then I will change my mind regarding the good that I planned to do to it or to bestow upon it. Okay. I'll just say one thing by way of introduction. I'm not sure this is the most introductory thought, but I wanted to just share this. The metaphor of the potter, I think, is interesting and not to be taken for granted, because it portrays creation as fundamentally dynamic and sees it as fundamentally artistic, right? In a way, it's a contrast to Genesis 1, where God speaks and so it is. Here, God is a potter at the wheel, and God is working at it until God finally settles on a form that God feels good about. Now, on the surface, this seems to be about a potter who is in total control of the clay. And yet, the text seems to say, sometimes there is something about the clay that leads the potter to shift the potter's intention. The potter is powerful. He can do whatever he wants with the clay. And yet the clay has a certain kind of power too, in that if it doesn't work or it falls apart or whatever it might be, the potter then can no longer stick to his original plan and has to, in fact, adjust to what is happening and unfolding. All right, I'm going to leave it at that for now, and then I'm going to try to complicate this even more in a few minutes. So let's look at verse 2. Just to sort of explain, not all this will be theological, some of it I'm just going to narrate. When he says, go down to the house of the potter, the verb go down suggests that the potter's house was somehow far down, probably near a water source, maybe in a valley or something like that. And it's interesting, already the word yotzer, which I translate here as potter, you might translate it as artisan or something like that. The word yotzer, the reader or the listener already knows that this term is used frequently in reference to God. Okay? So it's almost like the parable leads you to expect, perhaps, or not to expect, but not to be surprised by the turn from the human yotzer to the divine yotzer. Okay? And in verse 3, Jeremiah does exactly what God said. And then verse 4, so here's a comment by a modern Bible scholar, Marv Sweeney, which I don't really accept, I don't think is quite right, and understanding why I think will be helpful to us in understanding. Sweeney says, the analogy heightens the tremendous power of God vis-a-vis Israel. God is the master craftsman, while Israel is the inanimate clay. I think that this fails to reckon with what becomes clear in the verses that follow, namely that God is also responsive, and that Israel, crucially, is not, in fact, inanimate. That's where the metaphor actually breaks. Israel is not clay. Israel is an agent with a will and the ability to make choices. There is some debate among scholars about whether the message here is in a way positive. Just as the potter takes the clay that turns out badly on the wheel and starts over again with the same clay, so God will take unfaithful Israel and work with it until it becomes the vessel that God wants. Or is this more negative? Just as the potter takes the clay that turns out badly and replaces it with other clay, so God will replace Israel with another vessel. I have to say, I think the negative reading is hard to sustain in the pshat, despite the fact that many scholars hold that view. Because I think the language of, in verse 4, vishav v'yaasehu klei acher, seems to mean, and God takes this same clay and makes it something else. So I think the quote-unquote positive reading is much more in line with what the words of the Hebrew actually say. Now, I should say that, as you know, kachomer b'yad hayotzer, like material clay in the hands of the potter, is an image that gets picked up and used in the High Holiday Liturgy. But there, I think it is used quite differently than by Jeremiah, because Jeremiah's whole point here is that the clay can resist. The clay can foil God's plans. And there, I think what we're saying is we're making a claim about being really putty in God's hands, that God can do whatever God wants with. Here, that's the very picture that is on the one hand stated and at the same time almost negated. what happens in verse 4 opens the door to the oracle that we're going to see following in verse 6. Just like the clay, Israel is not independent, but is completely in God's control. Except how extensive that control is really interesting. So Walter Brueggemann, prominent Bible scholar, at one point, commenting on this verse, says, God is completely sovereign. And yet, just a few verses later, he speaks of God being responsively sovereign. The latter position, I think, is much more what this text is interested in. It is not about God being utterly omnipotent and the only actor, but rather God being immensely powerful and but acting in response to what the clay, that is Israel, does. The issue that the potter faces, you could say, is how to make the best possible pottery out of an unideal situation. And that is directly the predicament that God has. How does God make the best possible situation out of one that has not gone according to God's own plan, ideal plan? There is a certain power in this image that I think might have been especially moving to Judahites living in exile. And that is that this metaphor actually suggests the possibility that God does not have to destroy the people, but instead can remold them. And even when it seems that God has abandoned the people, God still has the prerogative and perhaps the commitment to remold them. The analogy between the potter working the clay and God fashioning human lives is already known to people from Genesis 2, by the way, where that's essentially what God does in the creation of Adam and Eve. I think that in these verses, God is making two converse points. One is that God can destroy Israel even though Israel is its elect, is God's elect, and that God can still work with Israel even after that destruction. Again, I think about this chapter a lot in terms of how the exiles would have heard it. That yes, God had brought dysfunctional, immoral, unfaithful Judah to an end, but God could still work with the people. Put that in another way, after the year 597, or again, after the year 587, this could actually be providing a powerfully encouraging and comforting even message. The fall of Jerusalem signified that the pot that God was making had gone to ruin. It wasn't any good. God had to start again. And the potter was re-rolling up the clay into a ball and starting again. But he was starting again. He had not, in fact, abandoned them. So the destruction need not be the end because the potter is still at the wheel. Now, when we get to verse 7, so God can change God's earlier decisions on account of a people's behavior, right? So God can have plans to destroy and yet not destroy, and God can have plans to build up and yet not build up. In each case, God is nicham al, which I've talked about before, means something like regret, relent, repent. The point here, I think, that the text wants to make is that there is a profound correlation, obviously, maybe not obviously, but between the way a nation conducts itself and the way God treats that nation. Here, beginning in verse 7, it seems less like we're talking about a malleable piece of clay than we are about actions and their consequences. Now, to sort of belabor for a moment the point I've been making, the metaphor of the potter and the clay leads us as readers, I think, to expect the complete, unambiguous assertion that God is utterly sovereign and everything goes according to God's plan. But the argument beginning in verse 7 is much more subtle and complex. It implies that what God does is deeply impacted by the clay, which again, as I've said, is not clay in that it is not, in fact, inanimate. Okay? The then, if, Vishav Hagoy Ahumirato, Vinichamti, then. I would translate, it might be helpful that if you look at verse 8, Vishav, if, and then Vinichamti, then. The if then suggests that God is willing to act in new ways in response to Israel's response to God, right? In other words, God's decision can be made temporary. It is not yet fate. What Judah is being told here, obviously, or if you prefer hearing it again as exilic, is that its future depends on its actions. It has the power to change how God acts. Now, it's worth noting here, I don't know how central this was to the author of this text, although I suspect it was important, that what is described here is God's relationship to nations in general. God has said nothing here about Israel in particular. This seems to be some kind of universal way that God interacts with the world. This is the structure of divine governance. If I plan bracha and you behave badly, then it turns into klala or curse. And if I plan klala, curse, and you behave well, then it can turn into bracha, into blessing. Now, you could argue that one of the advantages of framing, one level you can say the universal is just a way of saying Jeremiah is interested not just in God's relationship with Israel, but also in God's relationship with all the nations. But it is also the case that perhaps if you find an Israelite who says God treated us unfairly, God demanded too much of us, then what Jeremiah is saying is God treats all nations this way. This was not, in fact, a unique consequence of your being God's people. Now, another thing to note, beginning in verse 7 and then carrying on in verse 9, which I'm still thinking about what to do with, is you may recall that Jeremiah is here invoking the language of Jeremiah's own call in chapter 1. Chapter 1, verse 10, Jeremiah was told that he was appointed to do these different verbs. And basically, whenever those verbs are used, after the call of Jeremiah, they're used to describe what God is doing. Still kind of reflecting on exactly what that really means. In verse 8, I mean, I've already said this, but I'm going to just kind of keep hammering at this idea. Even a declaration of judgment, even when there is a declaration of judgment, the future remains open. It means that God is moving in a particular direction, but that process is not inexorable. That's what I would say. That's the real meaning for prophetically of a decree. God says, I'm going in that direction. This is what will happen unless, but the capital unless. Now, here's the thing that's really cool and interesting about Tanakh. In almost every instance, there are a couple of exceptions, but in almost every instance of God changing God's mind, v'nichamti, in the Bible, the change is not from an intention to do good to a commitment to doing bad, but rather from a decision to do bad to relent and change for the better, which just fits with my larger thesis about, you know, the God who always wants to err on the side of mercy. One very dramatic example of that, of course, is Parshat Noach and the flood, right? Is the flood where God is nicham, repenting of the decision to create the world. When you read chapter 1, you could have had the impression that pulling up and pulling down and building versus planting were successive. That is, that one will follow the other, as they did for Judah. But in these verses, they are described as alternatives to each other. Judah doesn't have to undergo both, but rather chooses through its actions which fate it will meet, either being pulled up or pulled down, or being built or being planted. Okay, with that, let's turn to verse 11, because we're going to see here this really interesting, I'm going to read verse 11 and then talk about it, and then verse 12 and talk about it, because they're so, the relationship between them is so jarring. So now, in light of all this, God says, Ve'ata, emorna el ish Yehuda, ve'al yoshve Yerushalayim le'mor, ko amar Adonai, hine anochi yotzer aleichem ra'a, v'choshev aleichem machshava, shuvu na ish midarko hara'a, v'heitivu darcheichem uma'al aleichem. And now, say to the people of Judah and the dwellers of Jerusalem, thus says God, I am planning an evil for you, a disaster for you. I keep trying to translate ra'ah as evil to keep the literary. You'll notice that JPS translates ra'ah differently every time the word comes up. Hinei anochi yotzer aleichem ra'ah, v'choshev aleichem machshava, and I am laying a plan for you. Turn back, each of you, from your evil way, and better your ways and your actions. This encapsulates, in a way, now as a call, everything we've just seen. I am making a plan. Rega adaber. I have a plan to punish you and make things bad. But if you return, then I will not implement my plan. God, in other words, has negative plans, but those plans remain changeable. You might say, if they take what God said in Jeremiah chapter 7 and the beginning of 8 in the temple sermon seriously, then maybe their fate can be different than what God is currently planning. Now, to go back for just 1 minute to Aaron's comment, Walter Brueggemann writes the following sentence about verse 11, which, Aaron, I'm curious whether you think this is still too strong. He says, the narrative here both uses the metaphor to assert sovereignty and violates the metaphor to assert Judah's zone of freedom. Now, your point, it seems to me, was that even the image of the clay is not an image of absolute sovereignty. But in any case, I think there's something in what Brueggemann is saying that is helpful. Maybe more in line with what you said, Terence Fredheim, who we've also talked about, Bible scholar, makes the comment about this verse that the variability in the quality of the clay makes the analogy, in fact, work with respect to people who are not passive and whose future is not predetermined. Just as the clay's quality is variable, so also is the people's quality variable. The difference being, of course, that the people have agency in whether they are usable and the clay does not. But the message here seems to be, I have plans, but if you change your ways, I will change my plans. Ra'ah, I kind of alluded to this already, but JPS here translates the first time, Hinani yotzer aleichem ra'ah, I am planning, I'm devising disaster for you, unless you change midarko hara'ah, from your wicked ways. But it's the same Hebrew word. I mean, here it really does seem that God is planning to punish them, but remember what we've talked about the possibility of an intrinsic connection. There's something really interesting about the fact that the same word is used for the evil doing and the evil response. Not the evil response, but the response of the consequence. You have to sort of know what you're getting in a particular translation. And the JPS, what's called the New JPS, is no longer very new, but the New JPS translation, which we've been using, always will opt for idiomatic English over capturing a literary device in the Hebrew. I sometimes like to tell people that the JPS is the antithesis of the Everett Fox translations of whatever books Everett Fox has translated, which, if you're familiar with those, are barely in English, because they are about trying to capture as many of the word plays in the Hebrew as you can. Robert Alter, in theory, is closer to Everett Fox, but he's not so consistent. So I just wanted you to see that here, the ra'ah ra'ah piece. Now, then notice the shock, if you will, of verse 12. Ve'amru, I'm not going to translate that yet, ve'amru no'ash, It is no use. It is futile. Ki arei acharei machshavoteinu nelech. We will follow our own plans, thoughts. V'ish shrirut libo hara'a na'aseh. And each person will act according to the stubbornness of his own heart. So after all this, the Israelite reaction is, nah, we, and then the question is that we can't or we won't. So first, I just want to say, v'amru, it isn't totally clear to me, I think it's not totally clear, period, whether v'amru should be translated as they will say, or whether it might mean something like, but they go on saying. In other words, that one is a prediction that it won't work, and the other is just a statement like, yeah, nothing seems to reach them. It's a kind of futility, that meaning the verb is iterative in that case. Okay? Now, of course, no'ash, we talked about this, I think it was last time, it might have been the time before, is an example of, they didn't literally say this word, but their actions suggest that this is their response to God. What I hesitated about here is this a statement of defiance or despair? Is it we won't change or is it we can't change? Is this the brazen sinner or the addict? I don't think that's clear. And I think you get a somewhat different reading and a different feel for what's happening here, depending on which way you take this. So just to sort of situate verse 11 and 12 together, if verse 11 is a dramatic declaration of God's openness to the people's not yet expired ability to save things, Jeremiah's report of verse 12 essentially says, sorry, but no. It's very, very dramatic because verse 12 is like as close as you'll come to an out-and-out utter renunciation of God by the people. Again, I'm not clear if it's despair, defiance. I just saw Fran's comment coming across the bottom of my screen. Maybe complacency. But no'ash sounds more than complacent to me. It sounds more desperate than that. Or defiant than that, but I'm not sure. One way of thinking about the relationship between verse 11 and 12 is that if it's addressed to exiles, what they're being told is that what now in retrospect seems like it had been inevitable was not in fact inevitable. It is Israel's action that limited, in a sense, what God felt God could do. Also, just notice a kind of theodicy here. When God says in verse 11, quite ominously, V'choshev aleichem machshava, and I am laying a plan against you, they then respond by saying, acharei machshavoteinu nelech, we will go after our own plans. And what that does is essentially say God's plans against them are a response to their plans against God, if you will. I just want to summarize a couple of the theological points here. I know I'm belaboring this here, but I really, you know, I said this class was about Jeremiah the theologian, and this is a really interesting example of that, I think. And then I'll take questions, and then we'll go on with more of the chapter. This whole unit is an opportunity to think about the complex set of interactions between divine sovereignty and human freedom. Because in a way, what the Bible is committed to saying is that both of those are very real and have massive implications for how things unfold. It is not a world in which either God is sovereign or humans have agency. It is a world in which both are true. The second key point here, I think, is it might be possible for some believers to assume that God has a will that is firmly set for all time. God knows exactly what God plans to do. That's part of what sovereignty might imply. But that is, in fact, not what Jeremiah believes. By the way, the idea that God is set in God's way and God always knows exactly what God will do can be a grounds for hope on the one hand and despair on the other, depending on what it is you think God is going to do. But in fact, Jeremiah wants to say, God is far more flexible and dynamic than a theology of absolute divine sovereignty would suggest. In other words, to kind of go back to this image I've used, the clay that Israel is has agency, and the potter takes the decisions of that agent seriously. There is here an underlining of God's power, but it's not only God's power. It's God's relationship, relationality, it's God's patience, right? It's God's hope, etc. To put that one other way, the thing that places limits on absolute sovereignty, the thing that requires responsive sovereignty, is that God takes human beings seriously. And in many ways, I think that that's at the very heart of biblical theology. God responds to what human beings do, and human beings genuinely have the freedom to do things. Which is why, by the way, I think one move that is very common among evangelical Bible scholars, which is to insist that the God of the Bible has total foreknowledge of everything that's going to happen, seems to me to be totally wrong from a biblical perspective. I don't think God knows what Israel's going to do. God has hopes what Israel's going to do. God knows what God will do depending on what Israel does. But God doesn't know what Israel's going to do, and therefore God doesn't know what God's going to do. God is genuinely relational. Lachain ko amar Adonai, sha'aluna bagoyim nishama ka'ele, sha'arurit asta me'od betulat Yisrael. And then lachain, which can mean assuredly or indeed, or perhaps therefore here. Therefore, thus says God, ask among the nations, has anyone heard of such a thing? Made in Israel has done a horrific thing, a most horrific thing. Notice the wordplay between verse 13 and verse 12. Verse 12 ended by saying that Israel would go acharei, verse 12, that people were going to go after shrirut libam, the stubbornness of their own heart. And then that is described as sha'arurit. The alliteration suggests that its stubbornness is ultimately its most horrific act. You understand what I'm doing there? The shrirut is the sha'arurit. That's a pun. It's not the same root, but it's stubbornness, willfulness, the insistence on the autonomy to make your own choices is what leads to this evil. Now, just to play Hebrew grammar for a minute, sha'arurit asta me'od is a little confusing. JPS translates, has done a most horrible thing. That might be right. I'm not enough of a Hebrew scholar, biblical Hebrew scholar, to say, but sha'arurit asta me'od actually sounds to me more like something horrible Israel has done very much. In other words, me'od is not a modification of sha'arurit, which is not an adjective, it's an adverb, right? So anyway, I mean, I don't know how much difference that makes. I think the answer is it makes no difference other than getting the Hebrew right. And then verse 14, I will just say before I read it, I don't know what it means, and neither does anybody else. Haya azov mitzur sadai sheleg levanon. Iminachu mayim zarim karim nozlim. I don't know what to say here. This verse is very hard to understand, but I think it has a clear intention, which is that what Judah has done is unbelievable. If you ask the nations, they wouldn't believe it. What has it done? It is not reliable in the way that nature is reliable. The question of the first part of the verse is, the snow in the highlands never leaves the rocks. It's like permafrost when it's on the top of the mountains. And waters don't dry up. They keep flowing. The idea is Nature is reliable and runs the same course all the time, but Israel is fickle and unpredictable. Something like that. By the way, yinachu might actually be amended to yinashtu, because yinachu, I think, means to be broken, whereas yinashtu means to be flowing, but I'm out of my league here. Okay, verse 15. Kishichachuni ami, lashav yikateru. Because my people have forgotten me, they sacrifice to a nothing. Vayachshilum bedarcheihem shvilei olam. And they are made to stumble in their ways, the ancient paths. Very strange. Lalechet netivot derech los lula, to walk instead in other ways that are not built up. Now, lashav yikateru could mean one of two things. It could mean they sacrifice to a delusion or to a lie or to a nothing. It also could mean they sacrifice in vain. But here in the context, it seems pretty clear that the issue is not that the sacrificing is in vain, but the sacrificing is done to something which is in vain, something that is not real. There is a kind of incredulity in these verses. How can it be that Israel would do this? How can Israel abandon God for an empty delusion that yields nothing? Vayachshilum medarcheihem would seem to mean that the idols or the false gods cause Israel to stumble in its ways. I would like to note that some ancient versions have vayikashlu, they stumble, which I think goes better. Vayikashlu bedarcheihem shvilei olam. And shvilei olam, which JPS translates as the ancient paths, that's probably right, but I wonder whether it has the connotation of they go on doing this forever. Because olam can also mean that. Something like that. Paths that they're age old and that the people refuse to ever turn off them. And here again is that central theme in Jeremiah that we've seen over and over again of the cardinal sin is turning away from God. And now what happens as a result? Verse 16. Lasum artzam lishama shrikot olam kol over aleha yishom v'yanid berosho. So their land will become a desolation, something that is whistled at for all time. Everyone who passes by will be made desolate and will shake his head. Here's another example of JPS not translating the same root the same way within the same verse, Lishama and Yishom. Now, it's strange. It doesn't really work in English. Everyone who passes by will be made desolate. But I'm trying to capture the literary play. Now, just notice the relationship between verse 15 and 16. The shvilei olam, the paths that they go on forever, will turn their land into shrikot olam, the hissing that goes on forever. Now, shrikot olam and yanid berosho, these, as we know from the Book of Lamentations, are performed at the site of ruin, in order to kind of like go poo-poo-poo, to ward off it happening to the person who's seeing. A person like not wags their head, and it's a way of saying, no, not on me. And the shrika, the hiss, is what it sounds like to you. It's like, ugh, it's an expression of utter disgust. The word shrika is an onomatopoeia, I think. It is the same sound as you get in English of shriek. I don't think they're connected etymologically. They're connected because they're both onomatopoeia for a simple phenomenon. I think that's true. One question about this verse that I'm not clear on yet is, does this mean that the land becomes a desolation and is horrifying to look at because of what the people do or because of the devastation wrought by God's punishment? What does that lasum here mean? Did the people do this to the land? Or will God do this to the land? Or is that deliberately ambiguous, perhaps? Not sure. Kiruach kadim afitzeim lifnei oyev, oref velofanim ereim biyom edam. Like the east wind, I will scatter them before an enemy. I will see their back and not their face in the day of their disaster. Now, the east wind is interesting. Maybe this is an overreading, but the east wind is sometimes used as an expression of God's power, as in the Exodus scene, also the book of Jonah. The east wind is probably the sharav in Hebrew or chamsin in Arabic, the wind that comes at the change of season and brings dust that causes lots of damage. Afitzeim lifnei oyev could mean either being defeated by enemies or being carried into exile. I think afitzeim I would want to read as exile. I will spread them, scatter them around because of their enemy, meaning I will exile them. And then oref velofanim ereim is a little confusing, would seem to mean something that they will be forced to flee. I will see their back as they run away. But JPS suggests, and this makes a lot of sense to me, and it's very commonly accepted, that we should read this as oref velofanim ereim. I will show them my back and not my face, meaning I will turn away from them. Vayomru, and they said, L'chu v'nachshava al Yirmiyahu machshavot. Let's make a plot against Jeremiah. Ki lo toved Torah mikohen, ve'etza michacham, ve'davar minavi. Because divine instruction will not pass from the priest, or wisdom from the wise, or divine word from the prophet. L'chu v'nakeyu v'lashon. Let us strike him with the tongue, the al nakshiva el kol dvarav, so that we don't have to listen any longer to all his words. Now, who is the they in Vayomru? Is it the false prophets? Is it perhaps the people in Anatot, which chapter 11 tells us set out to kill Jeremiah? Is it a general term for all those in Israelite society, in Judahite society, who refused to listen to Jeremiah's words? I don't think that that's totally clear. It might actually even be impersonal. There are people who said this. And yet some scholars suggest that the word machshavot implies some kind of vested interest, so that it may very well be the priest, the expert, and the prophet, who are the ones who are most threatened by Jeremiah, who say this. Now, devising a plot, nachshava machshavot, suggests that perhaps that the opposition to Jeremiah here is not like an irrational, visceral, emotional response, but actually something intentional, something that has been thought through. And then the statement that Torah instruction will not pass from the Kohen, and wisdom from the wise person, and oracles from the prophet, is actually really hard. Is it arrogance on their part? Is it fear? Is it arrogance born of fear? The insistence that Jeremiah is wrong, this will not happen. The powers that be, religiously, the religious powers that be, will go on functioning as the religious powers that be. Priest, wise man, prophet is essentially the religious authority of the entire establishment. Jeremiah is understood here to be the enemy of all of establishment religion, the priests, the prophets, the wise men. L'chu v'nakeyu v'lashon, I just want to say, is a tiny bit ambiguous. It probably means let's strike him with the tongue, which either could mean slander or more likely bringing attacks against him in court. But l'chu v'nakeyu v'lashon could also mean let us strike him in the tongue. That is, let us make him unable to go on speaking. I think that the Hebrew can sustain that reading. Let us silence him. It is enough already with our hearing his words.